Craig, I've got to say you're one of the names that comes up most commonly when we talk about exams. I think everyone's had a great new experience.
Slightly terrifying.
No, good. I still remember you, Craig, at the primary course in 2007 because you were
Doing
teaching.
stats?
Yeah, you were teaching stats. That was
Yeah.
your
Well,
baby.
when they took stats out of the primary curriculum, went
Shame.
and found the final coordinator and said, "I hear you need a statistics lecturer." So I seamlessly went from one pair of revision talks to the next. And you could imagine, only imagine the joy on candidates' faces when I walked into the final course because they all thought they were done with me. The primary. So there were four exams where people could have been for both.
That was the most entertaining lecture at the course. Plus, I've never had an entertaining stats lecture in my life, so
Thank you.
that was no easy feat. So hi everyone, this is Lee here. Welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break, and I'm here with Stan and a really special guest, Craig Noonan. So Dr. Craig Noonan, he's pretty much someone who's affected most trainees in Victoria and Melbourne with exam preparation. He's got his extreme interest in education. He's an ex-SOT, ex-ANSCA primary course lecturer, ANSCA primary trial viver, ex-ANSCA primary examiner, and member of the primary exam subcommittee. And also ex-chair of the ANSCA Primary Examination. So he's immersed himself in education throughout his career, essentially. And it's just a real honor to have him on board to tell us his experiences of the exam. So welcome, Craig, and really thanks for spending the time to be with us here.
That's okay. That's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk about it.
And so maybe just to start with, why do you immerse yourself in this area, training, education?
I've kind of got a lifelong fascination with information, and from there that ends up leading you into education, and that sits pretty easily with assessment, and I can almost force my interest in statistics into that as well. So it's often, and that's where it came from. I always knew I'd teach when I was a trainee. I knew I'd grow up to do it, and then I just looked for opportunities and then persisted with them sort of the whole way along.
And what was your exam journey like?
Oh, well, my course through training wasn't quite straightforward. I took a job outside formal training programs. I worked at the Mercy when it was in East Melbourne and did neonatal intensive care for a year and tried to sit my primary from there. And that went fairly badly. I failed fairly spectacularly on that occasion and then went to the Royal Melbourne and got a non-accredited job with them back in the days when you could sit the exam from outside. And they were pretty directive and pretty nuts, and it got better from there.
I think those experiences which you've described, I think that what resonates so much for trainees to know that we've got someone who is guiding us along the way, who's been through those tough experiences that I think trainees sometimes experience, and knowing how to navigate through those experiences is really important. And it sounds like you didn't have an easy journey at all through the primary exam. What are some of the key lessons that you've learned along that way?
Well, you can't study in isolation. You really need exposure to people who are engaged with the exam to see what is discriminant information, to test yourself against them and have them tell you you're wrong and go away and try again and come back again. But trying to do it out of the books without talking to people, I reckon, is pretty damn tough. So that's talking to people, that's short answer questions, and eventually face-to-face fibers.
And making
Fibers.
those, yeah, I mean that's really good advice. I mean, this exam is also about building relationships with the people around you. And I think that's a skill in itself. And I think you're right, you know, you can't study with this exam alone. A lot of people try to, and I think it's unsuccessful. But what are some your advice in terms of how do trainees build those relationships with people who will help them with the exam?
Well, I think that's the challenge. I think training positions, certainly within the major teaching hospitals, are easier. And then you just turn up to your duties and talk to people, form study groups, pool resources, and spend a lot of time explaining stuff to each other, I reckon, is a great step. And then if you have access to examiners, the examiners won't, like, we're all loyal to the exam. We're not going to tell you anything we can't tell you. But if you look at how we process information and how we ask you about stuff, you'll get an understanding of what it's like. And I think a lot of your learning needs to be targeted towards you, how you're going to be assessed. And so copying out a chapter of Vanda and thinking that's going to somehow miraculously make you a master of renal physiology, I think is flawed. I think you've got to tear it down into, they're going to ask you MCQs, which are facts-based. They're going to ask you short answer questions, which are 10-minute little stories. And then in the vivas, they're going to ask you some factual information, but then they're going to push you on your understanding. And so you should target those sorts of things as you go along.
Yeah. And so, Craig, you talk about the four pillars, so knowledge, experience, confidence, and structure.
Yes.
Can you give us examples of that?
Well, it's quite fun to imagine people you know and how they fit within that. You do need knowledge. If you have no knowledge, it's not going to go particularly well. The four pillars applies a little bit better to the final exam, where the ability to talk through a case is much better if you've actually done it and you've been in the room and you've sort of felt the pressure of it. But experience can also apply to, you know, paying attention to your drugs and listening to people argue backwards and forwards about why we choose which drug to achieve which end. Your confidence, most people know people who are disproportionately confident for their amount of confidence, for their amount of knowledge and experience, and they seem to get away with it. If you hesitate every time you say something, there's just a nasty human tendency to pounce on uncertainty and go, "Are you sure?" Which is the question that candidates probably hate the most in the world because it makes them doubt themselves. And I tend to use it when you either sound quite ambivalent about what you're saying, or you've actually made a mistake, and I'm trying to get you to realize it.
So maybe that's a good point. Something I talk about in the final exam is always, if you've made a mistake, if you had a lapse of judgment, and yep, it seems like a genuine error, the examiners will say, "Are you sure?" Because you're doing reasonably well and they just want to check it. But
yep,
if you say anything with an inflection or uncertainty, like, you know, "I'll give potassium," and then you seem uncertain, then they will ask you that to actually check. But they'll never be testing your conviction to a correct answer.
I think that's true. I try never to say never, and I always avoid always, because I break my own rules on some days. But generally, I think that's true. And then the last one, to go back to the four pillars, is structure, and being able to deliver an organized answer as opposed to sort of randomly fly-catching pieces of information. Truly, you're ridiculously well rewarded for being systematic in your approach, and that goes for every exam you've ever done and will ever do. People, if you have an organized approach, people will trust that you'll find the answer even if you haven't hit it yet. And then you can try and leave out one of those pillars and see what people look like when you try to examine them, and it, you know, comes apart pretty quickly.
Yeah. I just want to focus on those four pillars, because then I just want to reiterate for those ideas to all the audience out there. So it's knowledge, experience, confidence, and structure. And those are the four, you know, key ideas that Craig talks about that can create success for this exam. I think knowledge is pretty much just hitting the books and just time. Experience, I think Craig has said, it's about immersing that knowledge in theatre, really conversing with consultants about, you know, the choices of drugs they use, or why things happen physiologically. Confidence. How do trainees get confidence, Craig?
Well, I reckon it's just baby steps. Part of it is knowing what you know. And that's the other part of the structure. Like, there's a lot of material, and part of your job is to know what you know. So when somebody prompts you, you can lead yourself through your information. You can't remember all of it. If you watch me Viva, I can Viva pretty much off the top of my head, but it's very well structured, and every question clues me into the next one. And if you can do that with your learning, so you build it from the base, you're kind of setting yourself up for success in the Bible, where usually people will walk you through your knowledge. Sorry, what was your original question before I distracted myself and you?
No, I think those were ideas in terms of how trainees would build up their confidence. Yeah.
Yep, confidence. So just start off explaining stuff to each other. Try to forget that the guy in front of you might be Professor somebody or other with an interest in molecular biology. And just imagine you're explaining it to somebody who's about a year behind you. And in that way, it doesn't matter that he's got a PhD, you're just explaining it to somebody else. And I do that certainly for final stuff. I've got a trainee who will always be an ATY1 at the start of the year. And so I don't have to tell her what a propofol infusion is, but she hasn't done much of the specialty stuff. So I just have to explain it to her in a way she'll understand. So if you imagine you're explaining to somebody who's about a year behind you, you'll probably target the answer the right way. And when I start talking, I frequently lose the ability, like I'm not concentrating, I'm not watching the person in front of me so much. I'm so busy trying to explain it that you know, you can all just quietly fade away, if you like, because I will be quite immersed in what I'm trying to do. Then there are other strange tricks, like if the guy's staring, you know, he's laser vision boring through your head, you look back at their eyes, but you don't look at their eyes. You look at the spot between, and most people can't pick the difference between those two. And it's just I don't think it's a great trick, but it's a little trick. Don't stare fixedly into the examiner's eyes. It tends to make them a little bit nervous. Don't look at them, because that would suggest you're not confident about your knowledge. So, you know, you just got to go in there, deliver it as best you can. You have to expect to say something like, that's the limit of my understanding. That's all I can remember at this time. I teach my trainees not to say, I don't know.
Yep.
Because I think there's a disempowering statement.
Yep.
So I teach them to say things like, that's what I can recall at the moment. That's what I can remember. And that plants the seed, perhaps, in the examiner's mind the first time, that maybe there's more, but they just can't quite get to it.
Yeah.
Craig, that's
that's a really important way to phrase it. Sorry, La, because I really like these, the comments about phrasing answers positively. And, you know, that I don't know is a very negative comment, whereas saying things in terms of like, I can't recall this at this moment in time, there's a positive spin to it. I think that's a really good comment to make, and really good advice for trainees to take into the exam. Sorry, like
that's good. Having these words to be able to just interject at any moment that are really efficient ways of expressing something in a positive light, definitely useful. So, Craig, would you say if you don't know the answer to something, but you have the ability to potentially work through it, that you just say, look, I can't recall it this time, but maybe if I... Just based on first principles or just trying to work through it, this is what I might assume or might guess. Is that worth doing for some questions?
I think the Viva is a fairly structured, and there's a path that you're on. Good Viva examiners, like really experienced ones, can deal with almost any answer you give and will be able to rephrase their questions around you to keep you moving. So there will be no point in a Viva with me where we'll both be staring at each other with nothing to say. The worst thing is if I ask you a question and you just look at me, because I'm severely restricted in what I can do. The only thing I can do is rephrase the question and try and get you talking. As soon as you start talking, I promise you somebody else has been on this path and I'll be able to move you the way I need to go. Now, if you can answer my question, and God forbid, if you can preempt my questions and just talk, I'll let you run. there's a sort of normal amount of interjection and questioning that I have to do. And if I have to basically drag you through this Viva every step of the way, then clearly you're not going to score marks the same way. But that's okay. You know, there's now six little Vivas, three, is that right? Three tables, two examiners, six, 12, because I'll do two each. And the extraordinary thing is you'll have people who do badly on one, and with fear in your heart, you'll open up your second Viva, which you know is actually harder, and people will just rip it to shreds. They'll just do it. And it's one of the most amazing things that people's knowledge is not a linear continuum. It varies around that a fair bit. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, then you just got to keep your face as blank as you possibly can and just keep asking the questions with the same monotone. And
mm-hmm. Hey, Craig. Another specific question. We were always taught that, you know, if you get asked a reasonably broad question, that yep. it would be best to, you know, say the frame of the answer, a brief answer, or maybe the list, then pause.
Always,
okay.
Because that, yep. that's a so list type questions must be answered with a list type answer. My fear is that if it's a list type question, you mention one thing and you start going out and further on the branch and out on the towards the leaves. If we end up in dispute, when I move you on, my enduring impression is that I asked you a list type question, you said one thing, and we ended up debating it. So yeah. Really, just get your marks on the board. They're going to hone you down. It's a back and forth discussion. You can't stay broad all the time, and they are driving usually for one little thing that they want you to demonstrate understanding. So even if you start broad, they're going to bring that focus in very quickly.
Mm.
There aren't many general discussions.
Yeah, good. I mean, I feel like that's one of the biggest low-level fruit things to learn in this exam. Give me the list. Don't start talking about, you know, cause of hypoxemia and just talking about FiO2 in detail when you could just give me the list first. And I feel like that happens every time I examine someone when they start off.
Yep. So if you think about directions, over the final, you've got about 15 minutes for the primary. It's going to be it's about 5 minutes per topic. How many questions do you reckon I'm going to ask you in those 5 minutes? So it's got to be 15, 20, bad day, maybe 30. You haven't got a lot of time to answer those questions. So really, I want the first thing you say to be a good thing, and hopefully I can just keep moving you on. So I am a machine gun Viva examiner, and some people look a little distressed, but really my job is to get you to score marks. And that's what I'm doing. So when I interrupt you, it's usually because you stop scoring marks. You're either going madly in the wrong direction, or you've got the marks for what I just asked you. I need to ask you the next thing. So it's not social discourse. Some people look a little distressed by this. And there's a couple of other myths that I'm happy to discuss. You can't distract me. It is not possible. You cannot hijack my Viva. If you hijack my Viva, I will interrupt you. If you do not stop talking, I'll sit back and cross my arms and stop listening until you stop talking. You're not scoring marks by hijacking my Viva. So it's not a normal social discourse. There's no point trying to talk over me. This is not the way the game's played. It's a very different social. It's not like a social conversation in many regards at all. It's me like wandering through your brain trying to get the information out as efficiently as you can.
That's great. That's one of the biggest myths, really, isn't it? That fact that I remember being taught this back in med school, that if you're doing well, you can run the Viva the way you like it. And that was always
absolute
lie. Yeah, absolute lie. You've got the marking sheet in front of you. You know what you want to get out.
Yep.
And the thing is, I think for trainees to understand is that you want to be in charge because you are there to try to help trainees score the marks to pass this Viva. It's not...
So I agree. So yeah. One of the things, some of the trainees come in and they think they've got full marks and they basically lose them if they make mistakes with me. I'll shatter that myth for you right now. You walk in with nothing and you've got to earn every mark in front of me. So speaking really slowly to try and avoid making a mistake probably isn't going to help your cause. I have for most of the Vivas, I've got some sort of understanding about how much the average candidate can get through. And if you're ridiculously slow at progressing, then I'm afraid the marks will not be available to, the full range of marks is not available to you.
And that just comes with confidence. Yeah, I mean, like I always talk about talking speed. I've actually got like a little slide, which I'd say there is a certain rate words per minute that you're meant to talk about, where if you talk about, you know, at 100 or less than 100 words per minute, it's too slow. You've got to be confident enough to be talking at about sort of 150 to 200 words per minute.
Yep. I try to help a lot of my trainees remove some of their tells in the vivas. So tells are when you're confident, your voice stays up. And then when you get nervous, you slow right down and you can just hear the hesitation in my voice. You know, they'll stare fixedly into your eyes as long as they're happy. And all of a sudden the tabletop becomes the most interesting thing. And, you know, they just won't look at you and they're speaking slowly. So I try to teach my trainees that you just, you have a viva speed for your voice and a viva tone. The people who get really happy and excited when they know something, get rid of that. Just talk in the same pace and you just keep going until you reach the limit of your knowledge. And when I lecture, that's what I do. You know, you just talk up to the limit and then I'll happily tell you that's the limit of my understanding. Beyond here, it doesn't quite make sense, but this is what we all accept. And that's true in the exam as well. There's a lot of stuff that is in the books that, God help you, if you read beyond it, you'll discover that, you know, it's not that simple. But you must present what's in the book. You must present the party line first. And if you happen to have a PhD in that area, you can dangle the bait in front of the examiner and see if he'll pick it up. But you do not present the controversial material first. Just stick to the party line.
You don't play poker, do you, Craig?
I get asked that a little bit. No, I don't. I'm actually lousy.
I was going to say, if you ever did, I would not want to be playing poker with you just because of your ability to do tells, and you've got this really straight face, and you're like, I can't read you at all, you know. Now, hey Craig, I just want to talk about structure, because I think that's quite a nebulous term for trainees, because everyone, you know, when they get advice from an examiner or another candidate, it always goes, oh, you need to have good structure, but no one actually really defines what structure is. Like, what does structure mean to you?
So a lot of things will just fall into the same pattern of learning about it. So lots of the phenomena just have some sort of definition. I'm a huge definitions guy. I try to encourage my trainees to start their short answer questions with a definition that places whatever concept it is in the broader scope of what we're talking about. Frequently has a value, it has a measurement, it can talk about what its functions might be, although functions is pushing the word function, and then things that affect it. I mean, so something like FRC fits into that frame really easily. And then if you, you know, the drugs, lots of the comparisons are just, you know, the class, maybe an example, the mechanism of action, and then the problems with it. And so lots of the non, what I'll call non-core drugs, are just learned as comparison across that group. So beta blockers and then sympathetic agonists all fit into that sort of frame. And just calcium channel blockers just fit across that. You know, how do they work and how do they differ and what are the problems with them? So if you know that that's how you're going to learn everything, then you know that's what you're looking for when you try to recall it. And the more you can sort of codify your structures to the point that it helps you, it's useful. When you start trying to force everything into your preordained structures, then you'll just feel like this isn't working. And you're right, it's not working. The structures aren't helping you, they're hindering you. Mm-hmm. But having that sort approach and being able to say, this is what I know. So if you'll let me wax lyrical for just a couple of minutes, when you do your written prep, I reckon you need to be writing 10-minute essays. Those 10-minute essays should contain the facts for the multiple choice. And that's how I think you should do notes, not by taking slabs of information and writing it out, but looking at a chapter and going, so what can an examiner reasonably ask me? What do I want to be responsible for? And then you name the topics and then you do your 10-minute questions. If there's not enough stuff for a 10-minute question, it's probably a crap 10-minute question and you're probably looking at that material being MCQs instead. So I have opinions about what makes good SAQs, because perhaps in a previous life I used to approve SAQs. And good SAQs allow a range of marks within them. If they're a bit bimodal, because people either know everything or they'll know nothing, it's not actually an SAQ. It's a glorified MCQ, because there must be one thing that drives those marks apart. It should be reasonably significant within the curriculum, and everyone's got an exception to that. And I've certainly seen questions in the exam where I maybe wasn't really happy about that. And that gives you a, so if that's what you do, that gives you a little bit of ownership of your notes. Instead of going, I have to learn this, you go, I looked at this chapter and I thought these were the important things, and that's what I wrote my SAQs on. So the SAQs should be, whatever you write should be something you can reproduce in less than 10 minutes. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. You'll never put that information down. And knowing the simple stuff really well is more important than knowing a whole lot of relatively esoteric facts not so well. So when people fail vivas, sometimes it's because they haven't got enough knowledge, but more commonly it's because they don't understand what they're trying to talk about. So developing those SAQs, my cards type guy. If you see me at any stage, deck of cards will be in my back pocket or in my briefcase. I'll just put my shopping lists on them, my to-do lists go on them, and then the greatest joy in my life is tearing them up. And I don't find cards threatening, whereas trying to look back at previously summarized textbooks is like torture. Like, I'd rather re-summarize the textbook than try to match my old notes with the current version of anything else. It's like bamboo shoots under your fingernails, pins in your eyes. It's just bloody awful, and I won't do it. So they're not very useful to me, but cards do not scare me. Cards, you can just drop them on the floor, pick them up, sort them out. They resist most things, including coffee and red wine. They can be stuck in your back pocket and revised. And they should be my aim to make them my working knowledge, like what I reckon I should be able to learn and walk into the exam knowing. And so to that end, they have opening statements. And knowing how I think about things helps me, because I know how I'll process something. So there'll be a definition, there'll be values, there'll be whys that matter, you know, factors affecting. And so so that's what I think. Don't do slabs of notes. At the same time, none of our trainees are spoilt for lack of information. When I did my university course, there was no goddamned internet. There were no summary texts available. There was no opportunity. Like, it was really hard to find information to study. And now there's so much, and you're almost drowning in it. You have to do your own notes. Your notes are you understanding the material. I don't care whose notes you've got. I don't care whether they were the Renton Prize winner. They're of precious little use to you, except to help you understand it. But then you have to summarize it, and you have to put it down in a format that works for you. And I cannot stress that enough. Just reading and rereading, if that goes into your head, lucky bloody you, but that is not how my brain works. My brain works with me structuring it and then learning the structure that I put on stuff to make sense to me.
I think that was absolutely accurate for me as well. I had these amazing notes from a prize winner, and none of it went into my head, even though it was stored very neatly on my iPad. In the end, I just had to write cards like I did for the primary, cards on everything that was written by the prize winner, and that's what allowed it to go in my heads. And even nowadays with Anki cards, it still doesn't have that visual, the feel of writing something with all the slight differences in the cards and the ink blots and the, you know, the way I structured something offline.
Yep.
I
truly think something magical happens when you have a pen in your hand and you write stuff down. So, you know, I read lots of things. I'm interested in science. I'm interested in computer programming. And I can read it and think I understand it, and 6 months later read it again and go, I know I read this before, and God damn it, I remember, you know, almost none of it. It comes back, you know, it looks familiar when I look at it. But when you start writing, I think that's it helps your brain lay down memory traces. And I think it's better than typing. Like we're now dealing with a generation who touch type, but I have watched my son touch type and watch television at the same time. And I'm pretty sure he's not paying attention to what he's touch typing at that stage.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really key idea, Craig, that this is still a written exam. It's not an exam where we're asking trainees to type their answers in. We still ask them to write their 10-minute answers. And I think one of the consistent themes is that when you look at all the prize winners or merit winners in the last couple of years, they've got their own notes. And I find that really interesting because it's not as if like the notes, you know, the information has changed over the last decade or so. It still remains the same. But what remains consistent is that the people who do well always create their own notes. So I think for all those people listening out there, I think that's a really key message that Craig has for you is that, you know, yes, you'll have other people's resources and other people's notes, but don't just rely on them. Create your own and create them in a way that you understand them. And I think that was really useful to say that use it in a paper form as well so that you actually get that processing information from head to hand to pen.
There are things out, you know, you would all know life in the fast lane. You'd know deranged physiology. I really like deranged physiology because I don't know how he did it, but my God, they're great discussions about topics where he cites different references and includes the links. And, you know, if I want to understand something more fully, it's not a bad place to go, but it's just too much for the average punter, I would suggest. Life in the fast lane, I reckon, falls on the other side of that. I just think it's a little bit brief. I think it's a great starting point. If you knew everything in the in that body of work, I think that's a great start, but I suspect it's probably not quite enough. I know there are Anki decks out there that people have. My only issue with it is they become very disconnected facts once they're set as multiple choice. And I think you should be trying to integrate your knowledge. And that's why I'll put a shout out for cards as a way of embedding those facts in there and learning them as you revise your short answer questions.
And so, Craig, for the trainee that's, let's say, preparing for the August exam, what is your recommendation in terms of card creation? Like, do you do it as you do your coverage phase, or is it something you try to create during your revision phase? What are your thoughts? And do you base it around short answer questions or
concepts? No, I think you learn for the exam. You learn for the exam. So you can have, if I was going through Vander, I'd go through each chapter and go, just skim through it and go, what do I think the important points are? You know, what would those bloody examiners ask me about in that? Because that's what I kind of did when I was an examiner. You know, my job was to get you to engage with the curriculum. And so within the bounds of fairness, that's what I did. And so my sort of driving question is, what would a candidate who's engaged appropriately have learned that somebody who just tried to skim through the curriculum misunderstand? And that becomes a discriminant question. You know, now I've got, and you try it out, and, you know, things that people misunderstand that are important, they're great fiber questions. You know, they're good SAQ questions. Do you understand this?
Yep. And then you can frame it with the learning objectives, can't you? The ones that have been.
Yep. And I think that's a great guide. So the learning objectives and the reference list are there for you and there for the examiners as well. So, you know, somebody throws you a curveball question, you go, which learning outcome do you reckon that's related to, and where will the candidates find the information to answer that question? And, yep.
I really like the fact, you know, just trying to be very, very solid in the very baseline of knowledge at the start. Do you have any tips for definitions? Because I feel like that is the very first level. What is this? What is that?
Yep. Get a book.
Get a book.
Get an indexed book. So all of you can run out to Officeworks. I don't have shares in Officeworks. And buy 500 cards. I don't care what color they are. You'll need at least two card boxes and between two and probably four sets of dividers. Buy any pens you want. You'd be surprised to discover I kind of black and white, so black pen, white cards, but go crazy. gel pens are good because they're really low friction and you'll be writing a lot. And what was your question? Where were we?
Definitions.
Oh, yeah. While you're there, pick up a couple of alphabetized index books, things that your parents might have used to put telephone numbers in, and just start putting your definitions in there. And then if you don't know what to do, then you could look at the examiner's opening questions and you'll see a whole lot of them that start with what is and define, and just find good definitions for them. And because you want to be word perfect on those, because it's excruciating for you when you realize we've just spent a minute and a half trying to carve your trying to mold your definition into something that I can live with. And then you'll suddenly go, oh my God, this Viva can't just be about the definition. Like, we must be trying to get somewhere, but we're not. I mean, that's terrible. And because we've got to agree on what we're talking about before we can actually talk about it. So definitions are a great place to start.
Yeah. Now, I remember you saying this back when we were doing second part of the final exam practice, where you've really just got to avoid para study. So when you say go to Officeworks, make sure that is the first thing you do 15 months before you sit the exam, and definitely not 6 months before. Get all of that out of the way. Is that right?
Look, your study ebbs and flows. Like, you know, my work profile, I have weeks where I can get a lot done, and I have weeks where I'm really just going through the motions. What you don't want to do is legitimize para study so that it becomes the norm. So para study's my word. I own the patent for it. There should be a little TM on it. I should be paid royalties every time any of you use it. But it's something that it's anything you do after you tell your current life partner you're going to go do some study that does not involve the acquisition or rehearsal of new information. And so that's all that stuff, all the padding up you do. And, you know, if you want to be cruel, when you get to the end of your study session, you go, so what did I learn today? And if the answer's nothing, then congratulations. You just experienced para study.
But it didn't matter that you got some really nice color-coded pen feng shui aligned stuff.
Beautiful. Yeah. Lining up your pages, sorting, color indexing, all of that's just, sorry.
You were ahead of your time, Craig, you know, with this idea of para study, because now, you know, with Instagram, Facebook, para study is just so much easier to do, I would think.
You could collect a lot of information and not learn it. And I worry that our concentration span is shot. Mine is not as good as it was. I have this overwhelming urge every 20 minutes to check my phone, even though I have alerts, you know.
Yeah. Craig, do you think in this generation study is harder than what it was probably a decade ago? What are your thoughts with that?
I don't know. I don't want to make comments about the younger generation. I think there are advantages in terms of the information that's available. I think it's easy to become overwhelmed by that. And distracted by it. You know, I'm looking for the best article, and I often think perfection is the enemy of good enough. And you're going to have to settle for good enough. Like, that's what university work is, I think. At school, when you think back to your school curriculum, it is really quite constrained, and you spend a lot of time rehearsing that and making yourself really good on a very small thing. When you get to university, the world just opens up in terms of the information. You will never master your subjects again. Like, you'll never know the breadth to that degree. And so you are trading off. And I think that becomes clear at university. You know, I can get a credit in this subject. To get an HD, I'd have to invest a whole lot more time. And the primary exam, the scope is large, and you're going to have to settle for good enough at some stage and keep moving. Like, I've seen people who can't pass their postgraduate exams because they're absolutely fixated on being perfect, and they just keep redoing cardiovascular over and over and over again to their detriment.
Yeah.
Craig, how about study groups? How would you utilize study groups?
I think they're great. I think study groups are really useful. I think because it's like, if I want to exercise, the best way I can exercise is ring up somebody I know and go, let's go and do something together. Let's go for a bike ride. And then you've made a contract, and it's much harder to step out I can't go for a bike ride because I'm just a wimp today. You know, it might rain, it's a bit cold, I'm a little bit tired, you know. And the study group just makes you all accountable that you're all going to turn up. And you all help each other. So somebody will, you know, might have the statistics geek in your group and he'll teach all of your statistics. And somebody else will be a whiz at respiratory physiology and they'll teach you the respiratory physiology. You probably need about six of you because you're not all going to be able to make it. And you've got to accept that you're not all going to make it and stop looking for the perfect day because you all work rolling rosters. And so you try and fix it into your calendar and make it the normal. And you turn up if you can. You need somebody in the group who's really irritating and calls you to task. And that person has a very special role and should be supported in that role by stopping all of you wasting each other's time collectively. It's very easy if you look around and the other five people are all chatting and you go, hey, you know, this must be okay. They're cool with it. So we'll just all six of us can waste time at the moment. So you really do need that person to say, come on, to work. Yep, I think study groups are really useful. They're not. This sounds a little bit mercenary. You're not there to carry anybody. Like everybody's got to get themselves across the line and everybody should contribute to the group. You're not there to provide endless tutorials for one person. And to that end, it's a little bit mercenary. It's a cooperative venture. And study groups flex up and flex down in terms of their numbers. And sometimes you just have to do that. You know, might not be completely committed to the cause, and you really want people who are committed. Because sitting again is awful.
Correct. Just a question about we thought the resource available, from a big hospital like Monash or the Alfred or any of the kind of major Melbourne centres or anywhere around the or Australia, you have access to examiners and past examiners and lots of fanskers. How do we? Is there an easier way for the smaller centres who have just no access to solve this? It seems like a massive gap, and the let it's just not a level playing field.
I do agree, and I do have sympathy for people who are outside. So I'm, for my various sins, I'm a TAC inspector. So I inspect hospitals across Australia and New Zealand in terms of their suitability for training. And one of the great challenges is, you know, you're in a small country hospital, and usually the new boy on the block becomes SOT, and they go, congratulations, you're in charge of teaching as well. The guy goes, oh, really? That's hard. I think Zoom has made teaching a whole lot better. Like 5 years ago, you wouldn't be doing this. The technology what just wasn't there. It was really kludgy. And people weren't prepared to give Zoom this sort of medium a go. I still have reservations about it. It's much easier for me to lecture in a room where I can see everybody's faces and have little interactions and get little feedbacks along the way. This is harder. And if I could really try and evoke some sympathy from you, I have done my statistics lecture on Zoom with 90 participants looking at it. And that is just an act of just talking into the void, and I'm kind of an interactive lecturer, and it's really hard. So I think Zoom is a step forward in terms of teaching, and for geographically distant, it's the only lifeline you've got. But it, you know, the tempo of I've done vivas on Zoom. The thing I find frustrating is the tempo is not there. Like there's just that if you ever have somebody on Zoom in the next room, they're about a second behind you. That just means that when I go into close questioning, follow-up questioning, we collide over and over again as I try to interrupt you and you stop. It's horrible. So that's hard. What you really need, what I think most candidates really need is somebody to mark their SAQs. And that's the biggest gap in that's the biggest discrimination, having people who look at your SAQs and give you feedback versus, oh, I think this is pretty good, but maybe it isn't.
Yep. Well, we were actually having a chat to Lachlan Raffey before, and he was saying that he marks his trainees' papers within 24, 48 hours. And I think you do the same as well.
Within a week, yep.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for trainees that don't have access to that resource, what would be some of the compromises or some of the solutions that you think could help them?
I've got to say, you know, I never had an examiner or someone mark my exams, but, you know, we'd sit there, run a whole set of SAQs and have the examiner's reports with us plus our notes. So that was probably, 50% of the way there to an examiner. And I feel like just doing that over and over again really helped without the extras.
So you can mark them against your own notes. So my ideal structure would be you go through a reference textbook, you pick out the SAQs that you want to do, you write your notes for them, you rehearse them a few times, and then you look at the exam. And then you see what the examiner's actually pulled out of that topic, and you see, so how did I go in terms of that? Oh, my God, they found a question on this. Okay, so clearly that has been deemed worthy of knowledge, so I should probably consider whether I should have a card on that. And then the ones that you hit, you now want to see what the examiner's reports say. So you want to make sure that whatever they thought were faults in the examiner's, in the candidate's answers, you can now cover those off. And they do change across time. The expectations for questions change across time. So you'd want to keep that as part of that. So that becomes part of your resource. So there are lots of resources available to you. The learning outcomes, very specifically defined for the primary, much less so for the final. They release all their SAQs. The primary's not releasing STEMs yet. They release their opening questions. And so those are things that you can then, and then you know what the pass mark is for individual questions. So there's a quote in education circles that assessment drives learning. And if I was setting a paper, one of the things I'd look back is what did we do recently and what did the candidates really not understand? Because if it's important, we might like to recheck that. And then stuff that gets repeated, there's only so much physiology, so they're probably going to repeat the important bits. Those repeat questions have just got to be known well.
Yeah.
So there's lots of clues around that. So you could mark in your group, you know, everybody prepares two questions, chuck them in the pool, four of you, don't do your own, do the other six, and then somebody says, so these are my notes on it, what do you reckon? And this is what the examiner said. So you can achieve a lot in your study group.
Yeah, I think that was a very key message as well from Lachlan as well, is that don't mark your own papers. You need someone else to look at them, and ideally an examiner or a consultant. And I think the second choice would be someone within your study group. But the key message is don't mark it yourself. You have to have someone else read it. Craig, I've got some questions in the chat. And one of the questions is, this is a trainee who's preparing for their March sitting, so in a couple of months. What are your tips and suggestions for structuring the revision period?
Well, I kind of suspect that very few people actually have a discrete revision period. I think a lot of people probably run up to the exam still trying to put new information in their head, and that's fine. What I do think you should start with, and offer this advice in the spirit of advice, not to stress anybody out, is that you've got to do the big things first, because the big things are the complicated things that require real understanding. I still think in physiology and pharmacology, because that's what it was when I started. So for physiology, cardiovascular and respiratory have got to be done early, followed closely by renal, followed closely by principles of measurement and equipment are probably the four biggest topics, but the first two, cardiovascular and respiratory, are the biggest of those. For pharmacology, it's the big five. So that's induction agents, volatiles, analgesics, local anesthetics, and muscle relaxants. They've got to be done early, and they need to be revised. So when I'm performing really well, I rank my SAQs from just simple recall through to application, and on a good revision program, I'll go through those and build up to more difficult questions as my candidates progress. So they are forced to revise. So they're the ones. Towards the end, you must look at your past papers. You should know what the difficult points are of repeated questions and questions done poorly. And then at some stage, you should try and set yourself a nightmare paper. Like, you just pick 15 questions you hate and make yourself write on. Towards the end, you should actually be writing for extended periods. I don't know about you. I actually can't sit on task for 2.5 hours. After about 45 minutes, I want to stretch my legs. I want to go get a cup of coffee. My phone will be just burning a hole in my pocket going, please, please look at me. To have that discipline to sit and write for 2.5 hours has long gone in my life. And I've done postgraduate study, 3-hour exams. It was bloody torture. I just had to get up at 90 minutes and say, I need to go to the bathroom just so I could stretch my bloody legs, because it was horrible. Anyway, so they're all things you could think about as you revise up towards the end. There will always be little topics that you cram the night before, in my opinion.
Great. How do you structure your revision period for your trainees? Like, do you set them like 10 SAQs to do a week, or and then sort of some MCQs, or do you read around the topic? Do you have any structures of how you do it at your training program?
No, I try not to be prescriptive, because then I might end up in an argument with them about how much time I let them have for each topic. And really, I don't need any arguments in my life. So I usually tell them to write the revision plan for themselves, and then I'll adapt questions around it. We usually set about 6 done under exam conditions. And exam conditions mean write on demand. And I think there's merit in developing that, so that this is not something we do when we're feeling good with the universe and at peace and, you know, we didn't have a fight with our partner and we didn't come off call. You just do it. So, you know, we have an expectation that a 8:45, you will open the SAQs and start writing, and stop at 9:45 and email them through.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of just, you know, it's a training exercise. You've just got to get up and do it.
Yep. I mean, and 6 seems to be a very achievable number. I mean, that's an hour plus 6 minutes of reading time. So,
yeah, you can find an hour. When you look at stuff online, a lot of the instruction stuff is now down to 20 minutes for the vivas as an educational thing. And I think that's a very smart move, because you can always find 20 minutes. You know, sitting down for an hour to listen to somebody, I think is a bigger task. But 6 questions, that's probably about the right thing. If you're training a marathon, they say you've got to learn to run half. You've got to train yourself to run half of it. And on the day, you'll probably be okay.
Okay. Now, Craig, I'm going to put you in a scenario here. So you are preparing for the March exam, and you've just listened to this podcast here talking about, you know, the benefits of flashcards, writing flashcards, but you're sitting the exam in 4 months' time. Is there still sort of benefits in creating flashcards now? What are your thoughts?
When you say flashcards, I'm torn. So I'm thinking you might be thinking about Anki cards. My SAQs are on cards. And so it's always worth writing those. It is always worth writing those, because it's just not a waste of time. I say the same thing for the final exam. You just start writing cards and it's okay. You don't have to write 1,000 cards. If you write 60 cards, it's going to help you. This is a great format to get your information load down to something that's no longer scary. So you've got 8 points on your card. That's what you're going to build your essay around. Great. That's an SAQ. Stick it in your back pocket. You might even feel good about it and want to do another one. So no, I think it's a great idea pretty much at any stage.
Yep. And with cards as well, you don't have to make them perfect. They don't have to be your lifelong summary. inadequate, and you can improve it on the next one. It's nothing.
Ads are not hard to rewrite. Like, there's no greater joy going, oh my God, that is rubbish. I understand it. It's so much better than bash ad, and you can't tear up the old one. Like, as many pieces as you want, scatter them like confetti. This is progress. But you know, notes, you know, God, A4 notes in a full, in a folder, like, you're never going to get through those and revise them.
Yeah.
So the cards are great because they're not intrinsically scary.
I love the idea that, you know, you put 8 points onto a card, because I think that really creates the comfort that it's something that's achievable. So whatever question there is, you just need to know these 8 points to do, I think, well in the exam. Would you agree?
And so there's always 8 points, maybe more, but it's just, that's the idea. You put, like, I'll be responsible for this knowledge. I believe this will be an adequate answer. It doesn't have to be a 5 out of 5 answer. There are very few of those. You know, I just got to get across the line, and that's okay.
And I suspect that trying to do manageable things like 8 points means that you actually remember it rather than getting lost in the stress of 20 points or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely. You know, most of the questions that I get asked about stuff, I just look at the person, sort of try not to shake my head and say, you won't get to that granularity.
That's like, great.
If you're obsessing about this, you're probably never going to get to that granularity in your multiple choice, in your SAQ or your Viva. There's fundamental things you've just got to be able to explain to me, usually.
As we're getting kind of to the end of our session, you know, I think motivation is everything. Like, you just got to really want this exam. I mean, do you have any personal tips for motivating yourself through your exam journey?
So we haven't talked about life partner management at any stage. And this is something that I tell my trainees when we start thinking about studying, that you all have to go home and do this. You've got to sit down and say, so we're together, and I need to pass this exam because it'll be good for our future together. And Dr. Noonan sent me home, and now we have to negotiate how this is going to play out. And so you're undertaking that, you know, in your designated study blocks, you will study. And when you're not studying, you will do whatever it takes. So, you know, if that's cleaning the gutters or mowing the lawn or looking after the kid while your life partner goes and does something else for themselves, so be it. And it comes back to, you have to want to do this. So you should not be in a training program if you don't want to be there. Like, you've made a big mistake, and maybe you have to think about it. But yeah, I'm a little bit sad in so many dimensions, but I didn't mind studying for my primary because I thought it was an investment in my future. Some of what I had to learn, I didn't like. A lot of it I did. I was pretty sure I'd teach when I got through, so I didn't mind. And certainly for the final, it was just an investment in my life. Like, it didn't really bother me. I got a bit bored with it sometimes, but no, you have to want to do it. So sometimes something will get in the way. You go, I've just got to do this, and then I'll be able to concentrate. Okay, go do it, but you better bloody come back and start studying. If you never study, if there's just endless excuses, you've got to front yourself and go, why am I doing this? Like, why am I not studying when I have the gold, like, opportunity? And I've seen people do extraordinary things to find their time to study. It is very different to school. You are not endlessly rehearsing a small repertoire of knowledge, which was so easy in retrospect. You are learning new information, and that hurts, and it's exhausting. So you won't be doing 6 hours a night. You're delusional if you think you can do that. You'll do a couple of hours, and then you'll buggerize around for the last half hour. You need to revise what you've learned. But you've just got to, it's a marathon. It is not a bloody recreational hobby that you do when you're feeling good about the world. And your life partner should be able to hold you accountable for this, and your study group should hold you accountable for this. And you have to want to do this. Like, you chose this. Like, you competed to get into a training program to do it. Like, why would you blow that chance?
That's great. I actually found this talk actually very motivational. For some reason, I feel like going on and getting another degree now.
You better go. You better negotiate with your current life partner before you start off on.
My life partner's Stan, so it's gonna be fine.
You go for it, lava. Don't go starting any rumors, okay?
That's right. Purely professional. So look, we probably have to wrap it up there just for time. But Craig, it was just such a pleasure to have you on, and you've definitely made. You know, we haven't met many times, but each time we've met, and you've taught me, it's really made a difference to the way I've thought about things. So I really, really, really appreciate that and all the work you're doing and all the work you've done. So I think that's it. We'll sign off there. And any questions at all, please email us. And if you've got a particular question for Craig, definitely email us at lahiraandstan@gmail.com and we'll send it through. And yeah, thanks for listening and watching. And please share this with anyone who might be interested and wants to get through this primary exam. See you next time.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
No, thanks so much, Craig. That was so helpful. I think that having frameworks really just gives clarity to a lot of trainees out there. And I think, you know, as you said, Zoom has really made this information widely disseminated. And I think that, you know, we were having a chat about passing rates all across Australia and New Zealand, which is around 55-60%. Whereas I'm sure at, you know, your institution, you run at a lot higher because of the structures that you put in place. And
it's been a bit tough the last couple of years. I've had more trainees fail and fail repeatedly, and I am really struggling to figure this out. The multiple choice has turned out to be a stumbling block for more of them in the final. I still think it's a Zoom effect. I don't think people are you can look at I still think it's a COVID effect. You can look at COVID a couple of ways. Like, I thought it was a great opportunity to hunker down and just study, but I tend to be introverted, so it really doesn't, like, the socialization, you know, it's quite nice. We've got a whole lot of stuff done around our house because we just come home and go, there's nothing else to do, so we might as well do this, and you just spend time on it, and it didn't really matter. But I think a lot of people, and I suspect a lot of trainees, went the other way and just felt a bit fractious and unsettled.
Yep.
So it's been a bit tough recently. Traditionally, Victoria always did well with pass rates, and that's probably college headquarters, lots of examiners, and everybody else sort of falls behind a bit.
I hope that, you know, with, you know, people like yourself who are invested in this process, you know, and through collaboration and just through this network effect, that we can, you know, really create some positive outcomes for our trainees. Because, you know, as I was telling Lockie before, you know, if you had a disease with 45% morbidity, like, you think about this, you can do almost any intervention and create a significant difference to that and create great change.
So I'm not I'm kind of happy to support this because I can see some leverage in this process. You know, so my trainees clearly get whatever benefit I can offer them because I'm basically force-fed to them. But I suspect there's a wider pool out there that might miss out on that sort of input potentially.
Yep.
And I'm not sure how you fill that need easily.
Yeah, and I think you're right. This is the first step. But, you know, and I think I'm so grateful, you know, for your time. And, you know, I think, as I said, you know, having people like yourself with that experience who's driven such success for your trainees come here and talk about ideas and concepts related to delivering that success to other trainees around Australia and New Zealand is all part about sharing and making the community grow and be better. So, you know, thank you so much, Craig. Really appreciate it. We'll head off now. We're going to get you back on. All right, Craig. So, you know, I think next time, you know, it was such a great conversation. We'll have to have another episode, perhaps on a topic that you enjoy talking about for the primary.
Stats.
No. No, that's not.
Only screening tests. All right. We can certainly talk about that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, guys. Yes. Thanks, everyone.